I will be keeping my eye on the clock tonight because Compline is at 8:45, and I can't tell you how I've been looking forward to it. The Vesper service this afternoon was absolutely magnificent. What a great gift for me to be here to witness it. Don't take for granted the beauty of this place while you're busy with your studies here. There aren't other places like it. You can't find that kind of magnificent, beautiful prayer to our Lord out in the world anymore. Only a few places. And that beauty will sustain you years from now when you're away from here. So it's been many years since I've been here, but there have been times when I've thought back. For me especially, the service of Compline is just overwhelmingly beautiful. And I'm not going to bump into it tonight, I'll tell you for sure. So I will be keeping an eye on the clock. I am not good at it. I am a motor mouth, but I'll do my best. I wanted to pick up with the question of in what way can we view King Lear and Don Quixote as Counter-Reformation works? For Shakespeare, who was, I think the best way to describe it, a hidden Catholic, he does it in a distanced way, although it's very clear that certain members of his audience were aware of what he was doing. Very simply, and I don't want to launch into a Shakespeare lesson. It's all too easy for me to do that. But the premise of King Lear is very simple. A king, seemingly sane, goes crazy and destroys his kingdom. Now, you don't have to know much about English history to know that that's exactly what had just happened in England. King Henry VIII, out of personal whim, and his own private desires, simply destroyed the kingdom, divided it, got rid of the old religion, and left his kingdom in shambles. That's what happens in Lear. But what Shakespeare does in Lear, of course, is Lear becomes a tragic figure. He has magnificence in him. And as he falls, as with any tragic figure, he gains in tragic knowledge. What he didn't know at the beginning of the play, he learns through suffering, which, of course, is a thoroughly Catholic idea. Suffering is absolutely necessary to bring us knowledge. And since Lear makes his tragic mistake in the first act of the play, he falls for five acts in a row. No character in literature suffers to the degree and magnitude of Lear. So it's a horrifying thing to watch. And he first throws away his kingdom, dividing it among his daughters, destroys his family, the kingdom falls into civil war, and then goes into a war with France, and we have this sense of universal cataclysm that is brought about by this mad personal whim, let us call it the independent-minded assertion of a single man. I will decide. I will, never mind history, my responsibilities, what the church tells me, none of it. I will decide. And that is very clearly a Protestant notion. It's up to me to decide. I will make my own path. I will do what I want to do. Now, Cervantes is much more subtle. What he does is take, and it's the reason we get a comic twist on it here. Quixote is, very clearly throughout the work, a devoted child of the church. But there is one way in which he goes mad. And the way in which he goes mad is he has access to books that he becomes so obsessed with that they drive him crazy. They take over his mind and he is deciding to view the world through his reading of his books the way he wishes to see it and becomes completely detached from reality. What was happening at the time, and you hear it everywhere, as a former Protestant, I was raised with it, is that you take the book, and the Bible was becoming readily available, you sit down with it, you will be granted the gift of the Holy Spirit, you will understand it, and you can create then your own faith, you'll know God's truth, that comes to you in private by reading the book. It's all you need. Well, what does Cervantes do at the opening of Quixote? We have a man in private with his books, and he goes nuts. He goes crazy. The point very clearly that is being made, and very subtly and very comically, it is very dangerous to sit alone with your book without guidance. Okay? One might almost say there's a way in which the inspiration for this book comes from that marvelous verse near the end of 2 Peter. I'm not sure I can quote it exactly, but I'll try. Speaking of those who read the scriptures, I think he calls them the unstable or the unlearned, and wrest them to their own destruction. That is the recognition which is in scripture, very puzzling. The Protestants ignore it as they ignore anything they don't want to deal with. Very puzzling that scripture itself says to us, warns us, be careful of reading scripture. Because if you just sit down and try to read it, you can wrest it to your own, twist it to your own destruction. And what we know is the church is there to guide us. The church fathers are there to help guide us. As I was saying afterwards to some of the seminarians I was talking to after my first conference, anything that is difficult, we need guides to get through. There's a reason I taught Shakespeare. Most students can't pick up Shakespeare and just read it on their own. They would have difficulty. They needed me to give them explanation, background, help them explain what it meant. But these same students, good Protestants, could say, oh no, but I can read scripture on my own. Very curious. This was a new idea. This had come out of the Reformation. And there is Cervantes saying, okay, I'll give you a man who reads on his own without guidance. Whee! And what we have is a madman. A madman. Who's causing incredible trouble in the world. It's a small touch, but it's something that would have been there, that would have been understood, I think, by the original readers, certainly Catholic readers, would have seen it as a very clear statement against what I call the Protestant Revolution, what they call the Reformation. It's counter-Reformation. You can't sit down with scripture and read it. You'll go nuts. This man can't even read books of knight-errantry without going nuts. And it's a little warning there. So in that sense, in that background, it is indeed there. Now, having said that, it's a good-humored work. Okay, it is a comic work. But I want to begin looking at the very opening page. And it's a terrible thing to explain jokes. Forgive me for doing so. But I need to point out the humor because the humor is very subtle, okay? But the jokes are there all along, which is one reason you don't want to read it too quickly. By the way, this isn't a tangent, this is important. The beauty of this book is you can pick it up, read a chapter, and put it down for 6 months. It does not have a through coherent narrative line. If you did that with a Dickens novel, you'd forget the characters, you'd forget the plot, you wouldn't know what was going on. The beauty of Quixote, it is episodic. Very episodic. It is adventure after adventure after adventure, which means it's the perfect book for someone in the modern world who has to run around like crazy and has 100 other things to do. You don't have to feel, you have to begin at the beginning and go to the end. Okay? You can pick the book up, read a chapter, get a few laughs, put your bookmark in, and set it back on the shelf for a while. It is perfectly fine to read it that way. And you don't have to feel guilty about it at all. That's the way it's written. It's written in little bits and pieces. And you can even just open it and read a chapter, okay? Because it's adventure after adventure. Maybe you'll hit one of the wonderful dialogues. Half the joy of this book is just Sancho Panza and Don Quixote riding along the roads talking to each other. The most uproarious dialogue. I'll talk about the two of them. A great comic team, okay? forget Laurel and Hardy and Abbott and Costello. I mean, we've got the Don and Sancho, and they are a riot together. Okay. Chapter 1, here we go, which treats of the quality and way of life of the famous knight, Don Quixote de la Mancha. By the way, many of the chapter titles are pretty funny. In a certain village in La Mancha, which I do not wish to name. Why not? Excuse me, we're beginning the book, where are we? Our narrator says, I'm not going to tell you where we are. A certain village. There lived not long ago a gentleman, one of those who have always a lance in the rack, an ancient shield, a lean hack, and a greyhound for coursing. His habitual diet consisted of a stew, more beef than mutton. You're not telling us the city, but we're finding out what's in the stew he eats? What are your priorities? Okay. Of hash most nights, boiled bones on Saturdays, lentils on Fridays. Excuse me, why are you giving us Friday's meal after Saturday's meal? We're already going topsy-turvy here. And a young pigeon as a Sunday treat. And on this, he spent 3/4 of his income. The man barely eats, yet he's a gentleman. This is his meager diet on which he spends 3/4 of his income. The rest of it went on a fine cloth doublet, velvet breeches and slippers for holidays, and a homespun suit of the best in which he decked himself on weekdays. His household consisted of a housekeeper of rather more than 40, a compliment to the lady, never give a woman's age. A niece, not yet 20, another compliment to the niece, she may be young, we still don't give her age, and a lad for the field and market who saddled his horse and wielded the pruning hook. We know a little bit, we don't know much. Our gentleman was verging on 50, of tough constitution, lean-bodied, thin-faced, a great early riser and a lover of hunting. They say that his surname was Quixada, or Quixada. There is some difference of opinion amongst authors on this point. We don't know his name. Among authors, excuse me, who's writing this book? Now, I'm going to come back to that tomorrow because this is the first of a string of jokes that outdoes any brilliant postmodernist work of fiction. Nobody's come close to the games being played here, but I want to underline it there. There is some difference of opinion amongst authors on this point. However, by very reasonable conjecture, we may take it that he was called Quijana. But this does not much concern our story. The name of the title character doesn't concern. And by the way, you never did tell us where he lives. Enough that we do not depart by so much as an inch from the truth in the telling of it. The truth? You haven't told us his name. We don't know who he is. We've got 3 different names. You haven't told us where he lives, but the most important thing in your writing is going to be the truth. Okay. The reader must know, then, that this gentleman, in the times when he had nothing to do, as was the case for most of the year, gave himself up to the reading of books of knight-errantry, which he loved and enjoyed so much that he almost entirely forgot his hunting and even the care of his estate. First sign something's wrong, okay? So odd and foolish, indeed, did he grow on this subject, that he sold many acres of cornland to buy these books of chivalry to read, and in this way brought home everyone he could get. And of them, then we talk about his favorites, okay? And we get a quotation. The reason, this is a quotation from one of the books, and by the way, they were written this way. The reason for the unreason with which you trust my reason so weakens my reason that with reason I complain of your beauty. And when he read, the high heavens that with their stars divinely fortify in your divinity and make you deserving of the desert that your greatness deserves. These writings drove the poor knight out of his wits. And he passed sleepless nights trying to understand them and disentangle their meaning, though Aristotle himself would never have unraveled or understood them, even if he had been resurrected for that sole purpose. This is a riot. This is a riot. I'm just hopping down. In short, he so buried himself in his books that he spent the nights reading from twilight till daybreak and the days from dawn till dusk. The man stopped sleeping. No wonder he goes nuts. And so from little sleep and much reading, his brains dried up and he lost his wits. Well, I love it. Now, what happens? He decides he will enter that world. Okay? He is going to take up arms and become a knight errant. Having so immersed himself in that, he comes to believe in it as real, and he will now become part of that world. It's very interesting. One thing we can say about the novel, I was talking about this being the first novel. Those older books of knight-errantry were not real novels in that they're not realistic. But if you even look now at the popularity of novels, they fall into groups. The spy novel, the detective novel, the romance novel for the ladies. And they're a way in which you can lose yourself into a world. The closest thing to this today is the science fiction world and fantasy world. I mean, God bless Tolkien, he was a great writer, but what he unleashed. And now these things are coming out by the score. And I do know there are young people who just enter into that world and never come out of it. Okay, it's a danger, and especially in a time when everyone is less and less connected to reality, the temptation is to find this world, this imaginary world, and move into it bag and baggage and stay there. It's a very real temptation that anyone can fall into. It's an escape from the difficulties of real life. It's a more comfortable world because you can control it. But the danger, as Cervantes presents it here, and it is a danger that's always there, is that in escaping into that world, you will lose touch with reality. Reality is, and reality, this sounds stupid, but I mean it, reality is real. There is a real world out there. It is not accidental that he mentions Aristotle. That's part of what Aristotle taught us. There is an objective reality outside of my own mind. And my job is to discover it, know it, and make that connection so that what's real and true out there becomes real and true and accepted in here. It's never been easy, but at the dawn of what I would call the modern revolutionary age, it's become harder and harder. Until now we live in a world where virtual reality can be inhabited by people who don't need any connection to real life at all. There is the danger, okay? Now, he decides, if he's going to become a knight-errant, he's going to travel through the world with horse and armor, redressing all manner of wrongs, exposing himself to chances and dangers, by the overcoming of which he might win eternal honor and renown. There's pride there, but there's also a sense, please notice, of real dedication to a cause. We get the balance there. The Quixote is imperious. He's full of himself. We see it throughout the novel. But it is connected to an attempt to do real good when he's out of touch with much of the real world, which becomes a serious difficulty. The first thing that he did was to clean some armor which had belonged to his ancestors and had lain for ages forgotten in a corner, eaten with rust and covered with mold. It's a beautiful sentence. What has happened? The glories of his family's past have been neglected. What has been neglected? That armor. Nobody's been going out to fight. No one's been protecting themselves if they've tried to uphold the good. There lies the family honor in a corner, eaten with rust and covered with mold. Okay? We're told that riches will do that in this world. But it can also happen to The whole sense of family honor, it can happen to tradition if it's not taken care of. Quixote, please notice right from the beginning we're going back and forth. He's mad, but there's something sound there. There's some, the yearning, the desire is based on something that we can understand, okay? There is a kind of nobility even in his madness. And he's trying to restore the family honor. But when he had cleaned and repaired it as best he could, he found that there was one great defect. The helmet was a simple headpiece without a visor. Knight has to have a visor. You can't have your headpiece without the visor. So he ingeniously made good this deficiency by fashioning out of pieces of pasteboard a kind of half visor, which fitted to the helmet, gave the appearance of a complete headpiece. However, to see if it was strong enough to stand up to the risk of a sword cut, he took out his sword and gave it two strokes, the first of which demolished in a moment what had taken him a week to make. It's funny in itself, but then you say, okay, he a week with pasteboard, making half a visor, it's got to be strong. Let's see if it's strong. He takes out his sword, gives it a stroke, and demolishes it. And then we're told he gave it two strokes. We're not told what the second one is for. Anger that he demolished it? Maybe if he hits it again, it'll come back together. This is the sort of thing going on in the writing, which is why you've got to pause on it and look at these sentences. This is uproariously funny. This is funny stuff, okay? So he put some strips of iron inside it in such a way to satisfy himself of his protection. Well, it's fallen apart. I'll put a little iron inside. Then I'll be protected. And not caring to make another trial of it. Let's just hope it's strong. He accepted it as a fine jointed headpiece and put it into commission. I love it. I love it. Now, he's got to have a horse. So, of course, he's got this old broken down nag that he owns and realizes all the great heroes had their horse, and the horses had grand names. This horse appeared to our knight more than the equal of Alexander's Bucephalus and the Cid's Babieca. He spent 4 days pondering what name to give it. Love it. For he reflected it would be wrong for the horse of so famous a knight, a horse so good in himself, to be without a famous name. So he names it Rocinante, a name which seemed to him grand and sonorous and to express the common horse he had been before arriving in his present state. The name means the first and foremost of all the hacks in the world. He's got his horse, he's got his visor, okay, he's got his sword, but he's got to have his lady. And so I'll come back to this tomorrow. He chooses Eldonza Lorenzo, a farm girl who lives nearby, and she becomes Dulcinea del Toboso. Because every knight has to go out and do his deeds for the glory of a beautiful lady. It's part of knight errantry. So, of course, it's the farm girl that lives next door. It's very funny. We'll pick up with that tomorrow. I have to let that be for the moment. Now, beautiful touches. He's ready to ride. First expedition, he's on his own. He's on his own. Sancho isn't with him on his first little outing. Telling nobody of his intention, and quite unobserved, one morning before dawn, he armed himself completely, mounted Rocinante, put on his badly mended headpiece, slung on his shield, seized his lance, and went out into the plain through the back gate of his yard. It's not that crazy, okay? Throughout there are these little glimpses that he's not quite as crazy as he seems. He's leaving at a time when nobody's around to see him, and he goes out the back gate. Okay? Does he know he looks foolish? Is he embarrassed? We don't know. Again, our narrator doesn't comment on this. Please notice, this is the other beautiful side of this work. It's wildly funny, and then we are hit with something that is filled with pathos. Something very moving. What's going on in him? Why does he do this? We're not told. But there is something slightly sorrowful in it. And it's right here we begin to understand why, and we'll see it soon, when he finally gets a name, and Sancho names him. He calls him the Knight of the Sad Countenance because of the sorrow in his face and the long, long, lank face that he represents. The mixture of humor and sorrow in this book is inextricable, inextricable. And there are moments, little sentences, little touches that are very moving, but you've got to watch for them. They're there. They're absolutely lovely. Now, he rides off, finds a castle. It's an inn he happens upon. Night's falling, so he has to stay at a castle. He decides to stay there. There chanced to be standing at the inn door two young women of easy virtue, as they are called, who are on their way to Seville with some carriers, okay? He approached the inn, and he goes up and believes they are two beauteous maidens or graceful ladies taking the air at the castle gate. "I beg you, ladies, not to fly, nor to fear any outrage, for it ill fits or suits the order of chivalry which I profess to injure anyone, least of all maidens of such rank as your appearance proclaims you to be." The girls stared at him, trying to get a look at his face, which was almost covered by the badly made visor. But when they heard themselves called maidens, a title ill-suited to their profession, they could not help laughing, which stung Don Quixote into replying, "Civility befits the fair, and laughter arising from trivial causes is, moreover, great folly. I do not say this to offend you, nor to incur your displeasure, for I have no other wish than to serve you." His language, which was unintelligible to them, and the uncouth figure our knight cut, made the ladies laugh the more. Whereat he flew into a rage, and things would have gone much further, had not the innkeeper, a very fat man, and therefore very peaceable, not emerged at that moment. Now, it's his first encounter with the world, but please notice what he is doing. He is not seeing clearly. He is not seeing reality. What he is doing is elevating. He is seeing the women as better than they are. I was complaining to a friend recently that the more time I spend now in the modern world, which gets crazier and crazier, and the way I see people behaving, I have to remind myself they have immortal souls. They have immortal souls. Quixote, by his nature, is looking at the lowest of the low, who are real sinners, and elevating them in his regard, treating them as maidens, and addressing them appropriately. The next thing we see moments later, he goes into the inn. He's put up in the stable, excuse me. The innkeeper comes back for his guest's orders. The innkeeper found that the maidens had made it up with him and were taking off his armor. How are they behaving? Like ladies in a castle. It's just a beautiful moment. You think the best of someone, you treat them with respect, and now we see these ladies of easy virtue who are behaving like ladies. It's a lovely moment. A lovely moment. And again, very funny, but also deeply, deeply moving. Now, I won't go on. That's just a little hint of some of the jokes that we find in the opening. He decides he needs to go back home for a while. He doesn't have a squire, but it was his first little foray out. And he meets a neighbor who's riding along the road, whom he addresses as Don Rodrigo de Narvaez. It gives him, again, creating this fancy name. And the simple laborer says to him, "Look you, your worship, as I am a sinner, I'm not Don Rodrigo de Narvaez, nor the Marquis of Mantua, but your neighbor Pedro Alonso. And your worship is not Baldwin or Abin de Reza, but that worthy gentleman, Master Quixada." Maybe we know his name now, maybe. "I know who I am," replied Don Quixote, and I know, too, that I am capable of being not only the characters I have named, but all the 12 peers of France and all the 9 worthies as well, for my exploits are far greater than all the deeds they have done altogether and each by himself. Just starkers, bonkers, raving mad. But please notice he begins it by saying, I know who I am. Down through the centuries, the most difficult thing to do. From the temple of Apollo at Delphi, know thyself, to Socrates, the unexamined life is not worth living, to the question, that whole question of who are you? Well, he knows. Only he's totally wrong. He's not even close to knowing who he is. There is a movement in the book, a comic movement, of how do we know who we are? How do we find out? Especially when sinners that we are, blinded by pride and all the other sins that touch us, we tend to get confused, move away from reality, and create images of ourselves that are not at all what those around us see. The laborer who says to him, you're Master Quijada. I know who I am, says Quixote. It's profound, but it's very funny. It is very moving, but of course, he's nuts. And once again, we have things pulling in two very different directions. Now, he goes back, and when he's back there, he convinces the neighboring laborer to come with him and be his squire. Thank goodness. Thank goodness. As I said, a great comic duo unmatched. Many claim, and perhaps there's some truth in it, I'm not going to push this, that in these two, Cervantes was trying to give something of the divided nature of the Spanish character. It's not for me to say, okay? I wouldn't presume. I'll talk about the American character, it's my own country. But we can say that the contrast between these two men is so extreme, they are such a perfect, ill-fitted match in their differences that they are an ideal combination, even though they're going off in totally different directions. Quixote, very noble, filled with idealism, very imperious, has some pride about him, very abstemious, he rarely eats or drinks, totally willing to suffer any indignity for the great causes that he's about. And Sancho, earthen, lumpy, realistic, gluttonous, a bit of a liar, always little white lies, and most concerned with his own comfort, and totally baffled by this man he's riding with. Okay? But he goes along because he's promised a number of things. It'll be an exciting life. He'll get to see the countryside. He will get a squire's wages. We never quite find out what that is. And poor Sancho just gets battered and bruised along the way as well. But the promise of an island. Quixote says, you come with me, and since I'm a knight errant, eventually you will be given an island to govern. And Sancho says, oh, I'll get to govern an island. That's fine. I'd be a good governor. I want governor and off he goes. Okay, I'll talk about this tomorrow as well. Almost immediately, as soon as they ride out together, now this is the second expedition, but the first one with Sancho, we get the first and most memorable of the adventures. I say this is the one everybody knows, maybe because it comes first in the book and nobody ever reads any further. But there's another way in which it is absolutely appropriate. The first adventure is the adventure of the windmills. Okay? I want to use this as a kind of guide to how you may look at the adventures. The adventures in and of themselves are very funny, one after another after another. And by the way, in the second part of the book, there are even more of them. Part one is filled with interpolated stories, a tiny little plot Cervantes tries to put together. It's not much, not as amusing as Quixote and Sancho just talking. He realized that. Part two gets rid of the stories. There's nothing even resembling a plot. And we just get adventure after adventure and the two of them riding together chattering, which is uproariously funny. First adventure, the windmills. At that moment, they're riding across the dusty plain. They caught sight of some 30 or 40 windmills which stood on that plain, and as soon as Don Quixote saw them, he said to his squire, "Fortune is guiding our affairs better than we could have wished. Look over there, friend Sancho Panza, where more than 30 monstrous giants appear. I intend to do battle with them and take all their lives. With their spoils we will begin to get rich, for this is a fair war, and it is a great service to God to wipe such a wicked brood from the face of the earth." There's Quixote. "What giants?" asked Sancho Panza. And there's Sancho. "What giants?" The idealist with the ringing vision, the cause that he must pursue, ready to rise into battle, to wipe the wit. And the realist who says, "What giants?" "Those you see there," replied his master, "with their long arms. Some giants have them about 6 miles long." "Take care, your worship," said Sancho. "Those things over there are not giants, but windmills. And what seem to be their arms are the sails, which are whirled round in the wind and make the millstone turn." "It is quite clear," replied Don Quixote, "that you are not experienced in this matter of adventures. They are giants, and if you are afraid, go away and say your prayers, whilst I advance and engage them in fierce and unequal battle." And he spurs Rocinante. And Sancho's just, you know. But there you have it. Very clear, in that very first vision, two entirely different ways of looking at the world. Completely different, opposite. And yet, what a perfect match they make. Now, the windmill adventure does something else. He rushes up with his lance, hits one of the sails, which takes him and the horse soaring upward in the air. And then down to earth. And he's there, just a complete wreck. The armor, the horse. It is a visual joke that tells you what happens to Quixote throughout the book. The vision, the idealism, the excitement, the energy, the conviction send him soaring. There is reality. It's called gravity. Kerplunk. It's the ultimate joke. It's why the oldest joke in the world is somebody slipping on a banana peel and falling down. Why is it funny? It's funny for this simple reason. We are arrogant creatures. On one level, we are animals connected to the other animals. We have physical bodies. All the other animals walk on all fours. Some of them even claim they may be our relatives. Of course, we know it's not true. At least stay close to the ground. Okay. They used to do this in class and people would walk by the door. So that if anything happens, they can support themselves. But man, proud man, two little pegs, can use these to wave or, you know, pick your nose or whatever. Flip some pages in a book. Until we are proven subject to laws of nature, including gravity. Whoosh! Boom! And the reason you laugh at that is not because you're sadistic and enjoy someone's being hurt. It is funny because you are seeing the proud brought low. And we're all proud. We are all touched with pride. And nothing is better than seeing the proud being brought down to earth. Okay? Quixote is filled with pride and soars up in the air and is brought down to earth. Okay? And at that point, Sancho goes to him. It's just wonderful. "Oh my goodness," cried Sancho, "didn't I tell your worship to look what you were doing for they were only windmills. Nobody could mistake them unless he had windmills on the brain. Silence, friend Sancho, replied Don Quixote. Matters of war are more subject than most to continual change. What is more, I think, and that is the truth, that the same sage Freston who robbed me of my room, they bricked up his library in the house when he was home so he couldn't find his books, and they burned most of them, the priest and the barber in the town. And the same sage Freston who robbed me of my room and my books has turned those giants into windmills to cheat me of the glory of conquering them. Such is the enmity he bears me, but in the very end his black art shall avail him little against the goodness of my sword. God send it as he will, replied Sancho, helping the knight to his feet. It's just beautiful. It's funny in and of itself, but there's something else in it, and almost all the adventures are speaking to us in another way. Why does Quixote hate the windmills? It's what I was talking about this afternoon. It's the coming of the machine age. It is the coming of the Industrial Revolution. And Quixote may be mad, but what he knows in his heart of hearts is that new mechanized world is indeed going to put an end to knighthood, idealism, glory, and certain human virtues that will be replaced by the grinding of the machine. When he calls them giants, he is seeing them in terms of the books he's read, but they are giants. They did represent something huge and overwhelming on the landscape, and almost instinctively, as he draws that lance and goes racing towards it, he would love to get those machines off the face of the earth so there would be a chance that the nobility of knighthood could return. It's fascinating. It's fascinating. It happens repeatedly. It's something that clearly Cervantes was obsessed about. Whenever there is a machine that appears in this book, it's questionable. And it leads to trouble for the Don. And he is instinctively against it. He is instinctively trying to attack it or stop it or prevent it. Okay, it's there. It's going on there. Let me give you another example. This is, again, one of the beautiful adventures that comes early on. They're going along the road chatting. I wish we had time just to read through some of the dialogues. Oh, they are funny. They're going along and suddenly they see clouds of dust coming up. The dust cloud he had seen, it was caused by two great flocks of sheep, which were being driven along the road in opposite directions, but owing to the dust, they were not visible until they drew near. So emphatically, however, did Don Quixote affirm that they were armies, that Sancho came to believe him and asked, "Sir, what do we do now?" "What? Favor and aid those in need and distress. I must tell you, Sancho, that the army which is coming towards us is led and commanded by the great Emperor Alifanfaron, Lord of the great island of Taprobana. The other, which is marching behind us, is the army of his enemy, the king of the Garamantas, Pentapolin of the naked arm, so called because he always rides into battle with his right arm bare." "Why do these two lords hate one another then?" asked Sancho. "They hate one another because this Alifanfaron is a furious pagan and is in love with Pentapolin's daughter, a very lovely and what is more, a very gracious lady, and a Christian whose father will not give her to the pagan king unless he first forswears the faith of his false prophet Muhammad and is converted to his own." "By my beard," said Sancho, "but that Pentapolin is right, and I'll help him all I can." They're sheep. They're sheep. But what he has done is he's naming them. He's giving them identities. It's uproariously funny, but at the same time, what we know, because we're told it, our Lord tells us this, we're all sheep. We're all sheep, okay? We need a good shepherd. We need someone to watch out for us. And that is the best of being sheep. There's another side of sheep. They're very dumb. They simply baa a lot, and they become indistinguishable in large crowds. There is a temptation, again, in the modern world, to just become part of the flock and do what everybody else is doing and hide yourself in this great wash of humanity and not stand out in any way and agree with your neighbors and go along with what everybody says and just go, bah, bah, bah. Quixote will have none of it. He will not allow sheep to be that. Notice what he does. He individualizes and particularizes them. He gives them names. And in giving them names, he won't let them just be part of the flock. Now he goes on and creates this extraordinary adventure of what's actually going on. That again, please notice, he gets so good at it, Sancho believes him this time. Sounds good to me. Oh, well, we've got to fight for the good guy then. I mean, it's just amazing. But it is part of the intensity of that vision that occasionally Sancho will share. Until, of course, Quixote goes nuts and he's going to fight on the side of the right. He goes riding into the floor and starts killing the sheep. And the shepherds are going crazy. What are you doing? What are you doing? And Sancho at that point says, they look awfully, awfully like sheep to me. And of course, as the poor bloody carcasses of the dead animals are lying there, Sancho says, I think they were sheep. And Quixote says, oh, those enchanters did it again. No. Again, it's riotously funny. It's riotously funny. But look at what he's doing. And again, it is this. What do we know? We know there is reality. We know it's real. We know a sheep is a sheep. We know he's crazy. But we also know what? There is behind all of the created world a whole world of spirits. For Quixote and his madness, it's the enchanters who are constantly devising things to attack him. Well, what do we know? We know for a fact that our battle is not against necessarily flesh and blood, but against, as St. Paul tells us, those dark spirits that are there ready to attack us that we cannot see. Quixote's vision is flawed, but he is perhaps detached from reality, but he's also trying to see beyond the mere mundane and real. Is there something else behind there? Only he creates it himself, not trying to connect what may be there, but he's acting on the unseen, which can be good in a way. But being human, he keeps botching it, because his vision isn't clear, his mind is clouded, okay? And we get, now, I was going to go through some others. I'm going to stop there with that. But when you come to these adventures, each one is rich, rich in some way. They deserve pondering. They're very funny, they're delightful, but what I'm saying is there is depth to these adventures. There's more going on than just, children can read it and laugh, as they should. You get a little older, you begin to perceive there's more here than meets the eye. There's more going on in these adventures. Now, clearly, the Don is mad. But he has moments of extraordinary sanity. I just want to look at one. This is from part two. And at moments when he is sane, he's extraordinary. He gets into an argument about when one should take action, when one should take up arms. So I'm going to read this passage. Listen to this. This is the madman talking. No. God does not permit or desire that. That is, that everybody goes around with swords and just attacking each other. Prudent men and well-ordered states must take up arms, unsheathe their swords, and imperil their persons, their lives, and their goods for four causes only. Firstly, to defend the Catholic faith. Secondly, in self-defense, which is permitted by law, natural and divine. Thirdly, in defense of honor, family, and estates. Fourthly, in their king's service in a just war. And if we wish to add a fifth count, which can be reckoned as part of the second, in defense of one's country. To these five principal causes can be added some others which are just and reasonable and compel one to take up arms. But whoever takes them up for trifles or for matters laughable and amusing rather than insulting is, in my opinion, lacking all good sense. Besides, the taking of unjust vengeance, and no vengeance can be just, goes directly against the sacred law we profess, by which we are commanded to do good to our enemies and to love those who hate us, a commandment which may seem rather difficult to obey, but which is only so for those who partake less of God than of the world, and more of the flesh than of the spirit. For Jesus Christ, God and true man, who never lied, nor could, nor can lie, being our lawgiver, said that his yoke was gentle and his burden light, and therefore he could not have commanded us to do anything impossible to perform. So, my dear sirs, you are bound to keep the peace by law divine and human. This is a madman speaking. Sancho says, the devil take me if this master of mine isn't a theologian. All of a sudden, out of his mouth will come these speeches of extraordinary brilliance and clarity. And then 10 seconds later, he's attacking something else. Well, what can you say? It's human beings. This strange combination of glorious potential, real knowledge, great goodness, and incredible failings that at any moment can drag us down, turn us around, and make total fools of ourselves and get us doing things that we should never do. It is very human. It is human nature. Now, Sancho himself, for all of his love of eating and drinking and sleeping, the basics, who can complain? Quixote's giving him instructions early on about his duties as squire. So, Sancho Panza, you must be warned by what I'm going to say, for it greatly concerns the welfare of us both. It is that when you see us insulted by such rabble, you must not wait for me to draw my sword on them, for I shall on no account do so. But you must draw your own and chastise them at your pleasure. Should any knights come to their aid or defense, I shall not know how to protect you and shall attack them with all my strength, and you have already 1,000 signs and proofs of the height to which the valor of this strong mind of mine can reach. Sancho's response, sir, I am a peaceable, mild, quiet man, and I can overlook any kind of injury. It's the wonderful Groucho Marx line. Those are my principles, and if you don't like them, I have others. I can overlook any kind of injury, for I have a wife to keep and children to bring up. So let me tell your worship by way of a hint, for it's not my place to give orders, that I shall on no account draw my sword against peasant or against knight, and that from now on before God, I pardon whatever insults have been or shall be done me, whether by person high or low, rich or poor, by gentleman or by commoner, without exception of rank or quality. There's a sweetness there, okay? Before they even trespass against him, he already forgives them. But it's not quite what we're instructed to do. He will come out with these extraordinary things. We'll see more of them tomorrow. I'm nearly out of time, so I have to do this quickly. But listen to this. This is beautiful. This is from part two. And I'll talk about the Duke and the Duchess tomorrow. We'll meet them tomorrow. They appear in part two. And Sancho's talking to the Duchess. They're at the Ducal Palace and are being entertained royally. And the Duchess is just wondering how Sancho can keep following this man. How do you do it? And he says, I can do nothing else. I have to follow him. We're of the same village. I've eaten his bread. I love him dearly. I'm grateful to him. He gave me his ass colts, and what is more, I'm faithful. And so it's impossible for anything to part us except the man with the pick and shovel. And if your highness doesn't wish them to give me the promised governorship, God made me without it, and perhaps my not getting it may redound to the good of my conscience. For though I'm a fool, I understand the proverb which says, for his own hurt the ant sprouted wings. Don't get above your station. Don't get above yours. The simplicity, the sweetness of character. Absolutely beautiful. One of the joys, again, of reading. You can pick it up, open to a chapter, one of the dialogues between the two. You will learn, you will laugh, and you'll be richer for it. And it's one reason it's a great book. Tomorrow I will move into part two, which has its own peculiarities. We'll talk about that then. Nearly 8:30, time for a couple quick questions, just very quick ones, or you can hold them till tomorrow. We'll have a little more time tomorrow afternoon. I'd be happy to take them then.
Is there any significance to Sancho writing the answer?
Oh, absolutely. Well, yeah, I mean, it's part of the simplicity, humility, and humbleness of him. He rides an ass named Dapple. And, of course, Quixote has his thin, lean, old hunk of horse flesh. And Sancho, who's fat and round, is his fat and round ass that he rides on. But it's clearly a sign of humility. There's a wonderful moment. Dapple is stolen from Sancho at one point. And then a few chapters later, Cervantes has forgotten that, and Sancho is riding on Dapple again. Well, in part two, when part two is published, Sancho complains that whoever did the printing got it all wrong. They're claiming the author forgot, but it wasn't the author. It was the other people who did. Cervantes making excuses for himself. In the second part, it's uproariously funny. It's very funny. Part of his humility, very real humility. Man, he does know himself. He's not getting above himself. He just wants to stay where he is. Yet he wants that island. He wants to govern an island. I'll talk about it tomorrow. It's quite extraordinary. Yes?
Dr. White, do you see a connection between the windmills that Don Quixote attacks and Dante's description of Lucifer in the Inferno?
Isn't that fascinating? Yes, the vision. We get to the very core of hell, where, of course, in Dante, it's not hot, it's cold. The pit of hell is frozen, and Satan himself is frozen in ice. With the three faces, the parody of the Trinity, gnawing on the three most abject sinners, Judas, Brutus, and Cassius, all of whom betrayed benefactors, the lowest of the low, according to Dante. But Satan is also described there. Lucifer has these enormous wings that just keep going up and down automatically like windmills, Dante says. Yeah. I guess what I would say, there is a connection. I don't know if Cervantes knew Dante or not, but the connection is the sense of something machine-like, repetitive, this endless repetitive motion for its own sake that is inhuman. And it's part of the mark of the inhumanity of Satan, is that those wings, he's not controlling those wings. The wings just go up, the wings go down, the way windmills turn. There is a connection in idea, if not in actual influence. Yeah, it's something hellish, Yes. Yeah.
Why is it that everything that happens to Don Quixote is an adventure?
It's a wonderful question. I guess I would say he's in his 50s. We're told he's verging on 50. It shows up constantly in the press now, 90-year-old woman takes up skydiving. I mean, these stories are everywhere now, 107-year-old man runs Boston Marathon. Part of it is they're getting publicity, it's renown, which Quixote is after, but there's also a sense of coming to the, to put it politely, the latter stages of your life and wondering what you've done with it. And what we know about Quixote is for years he sat in his room and read these silly books. And in an attempt to go out and act in the world now, there is an attempt to live life finally when he's been removed from life. Doesn't quite know how to do it, but the glorious thing is he is so full of this passion, whatever happens to him out in the world isn't just an event, it becomes an adventure. He is turning everything in his life into a meaningful moment, which in a way is how we're supposed to live our lives, every moment precious, everything we encounter to be relished and enjoyed and appreciated, but we're supposed to be thinking clearly. We don't always do that. We don't always do that. And the terrible burden of the modern world, you hear it from the young constantly, is I'm bored. I'm bored. I'm so bored. I don't know what to do. Oh, I'm bored. Now with computers and the internet, they can sort of play endlessly, but they're still bored. That point will come. By the way, I'm told that the word boredom didn't exist until the 18th century. The idea did not exist. You cannot find any record of someone being bored until the 18th century. It's interesting, again, by the time the machines had taken over and there was less stuff to do, people didn't know what to do with themselves. They had leisure time, but, you know what most people do with leisure time now? They watch American Idol and go to McDonald's again. It's hardly an exciting life. I mean, they are bored. They're just simply bored. But Quixote is not bored. He's making the most. So all of his life becomes an adventure. Again, what Sancho wants to do endlessly is just sit under a tree. And if he's got a little bread and cheese, he's quite happy. He's quite happy. But and he's leery of these adventures. Sometimes he's drawn in. Sometimes he tries to stop Quixote. The greatest of the adventures comes tomorrow. Oh, I can't wait. I just love it. Where he gets a new name. He goes from being the Knight of the Sad Countenance. He gets a new name in the second part, but we'll hit that tomorrow. Yes.
Yes, Dr. White, do you see a particular significance in why Sancho gets more bold in his critique of Don Quixote as the book goes along?
Yeah, and in fact, he gets more bold, and there are moments of really curious switcheroo where they spend so much time together, all of a sudden... classic moment that we'll get tomorrow is the one moment when Dulcinea del Toboso actually appears in the novel. And all of a sudden, at this grand climactic moment, we get a switcheroo. And it's very mysterious and fascinating. They're spending all their time together. You spend that much time with another person talking constantly, and you're going to start exchanging more than ideas. There's going to be influence going back and forth. Yeah. So they are dynamic characters. They don't stay one thing all the way through. There are surprises along the way. Yes. Thank you, and I'm looking forward to compliments.